Thank you, Kate, and I also want to thank Ian and Emma and the many students, the Radical Student Union, the many students that have been involved in really putting this campaign on the map here at UMass. It's not often that students at any one university can have such an impact to resolve such a terrible human rights situation as exists with Coca-Cola. But before we're done here, I hope you'll understand that you're in a remarkable position whereby if we could kick Coke off this campus, it would have an enormous impact to resolve this situation. First of all, I want to say that, after months of investigation, all evidence shows that the Coca-Cola company is an enterprise rife with immorality, corruption, and complicity in gross human rights violations, including murder and torture. It is also a company that operates with unrestrained greed. Now, we don't believe that any colleges or universities should be lending their name or their reputations to corporations like Coca-Cola that have shown such an antisocial, immoral, and criminal conduct. And that is what we're doing at a campus like the University of Massachusetts. You are lending your name, you're lending your logo, you're serving as a marketplace for a company like Coca-Cola to monopolize the sales of all kinds of beverages. And you know, when you think that the only beverage here that you can buy on this campus is a Coca-Cola beverage, unless you drink something like coffee or milk that they don't make. So the impact that you could have by kicking Coke off goes beyond a city much larger than this campus, because in cities, you can go in and you can have a choice of what to buy. At UMass, you don't have a choice. In July of 2001, the International Labor Rights Fund, the United Steelworkers Union, filed a lawsuit on behalf of Sonaltanol, the National Union of Food and Industry Workers, several of its members, and the estate of Isidro Gil, one of its murdered union officers. The lawsuit charges that Coca-Cola bottlers contracted with or otherwise directed paramilitary security forces that used extreme violence and murdered, tortured, and kidnapped union leaders in order to, quiet union leaders, in order to muzzle them, all right, in order to stop them from organizing the union to protect the safety of the workers at the Coca-Cola bottling plants. They want to silence union leaders, and they'll use all these methods to do it. The year that the lawsuit was filed, the Coca-Cola company made over $4 billion in profits and paid its chief executive officer over $105 million. Now, when I talk about a company that is also guilty of unrestrained greed, let's look at what happened last year. Last year, the Coca-Cola company paid its six top officers $8.4 million in bonuses. At the same time, it laid off 3,700 of its employees, or 7% of its workforce. They could have given each one of those laid off employees $2,300. At the same time, the CEO that I told you made $105 million when the lawsuit was filed in 2001. Right now, his restricted stock options are worth $86 million. Council member Hiram Montserrat of New York City, who has a district very largely populated with Colombians, he went on a fact-finding tour made up of union representatives and students to Columbia in January of this year. That fact-finding delegation put out a preliminary report and then put out a final report on April the 2nd. The basic conclusion of that report is that the Coca-Cola company, headquartered in Atlanta, is complicit in human rights violations against its workers in Colombia. As part of this report, there were two interesting things that came out, and I'm sure Dan will talk a lot more, perhaps, about what's in that report. But number one, Coca-Cola representatives said that their employees, their managers, could have collaborated with the paramilitary security forces, which the lawsuit has charges. Could have, but of course, it was not at the direction of Coca-Cola. Secondly, in all the years that this has been going on, and in the brochure that we hand out, you can see where we talk about the murders of union leaders starting in 1989. Never has Coca-Cola, according to their representatives, ever done any internal or external investigation about these allegations, about the murders, about the torture, about the kidnappings, about what's been going on inside and outside their plants. In the case of Isidro Gil, this is what happened. The lawsuit centers around his case, all right? And on December 5th, 1996, paramilitary security forces came to the plant and murdered union officer Isidro Gil. That night, they set the Union office ablaze. The next day, these paramilitary security forces marched into the Coca-Cola plant, gathered up all the workers, told the workers that if they did not resign by 4 p.m., they too would be murdered, as was their union leader, Isidro. Resignation forms were there prepared by Coca-Cola management for those persons to sign and resign. In order to save their own lives, they signed and ended up resigning, not only from the union, but leaving. Workers who were making $380 per month now were making $130 a month. And as Council Member Montserrat's report said, it is shown that as the violence increases around contract negotiations times, so the profits of Coca-Cola rise up. So it's a clear correlation. You can see if workers are making $380 a month and then they're making $130, how much Coca-Cola is making off of this violence. One of the important things that our campaign is involved in is trying to make Coca-Cola do the right thing, even though for the wrong reasons. We have to force them to take what we call the low road to morality. That means we have to bring real economic and political pressure to bear on them. How do we do this? Number one, you can see from the materials that we put together that we are challenging the image that Coca-Cola has spent billions of dollars and decades to create. We cannot match them to go out and hire with hundreds of millions of dollars a year, the best Madison Avenue advertising firms that money can buy. But we feel with our volunteers that we can create images and write the story about what is happening at their plants, and we can meet them head on. But that's why we're coming to people like yourself, students on college and university campuses across the country, high school students who are going to the unions and to community groups. But this is one of the most important marketplaces for this company is the colleges and universities. This is where they rape literally hundreds of millions of dollars of their profits. Secondly, I thought we had 10 or 15. What is it? Oh, you lied. Okay, because I was going to wrap up by, okay. Secondly, a critical component of our campaign is we're not calling for a boycott of Coke, the campaign to stop killing Coke. There are many reasons why. But at the same time, we are supporting those that are calling for a boycott of Coke. But what we are really pushing is cutting out Coca-Cola's markets. So we fully support cutting out their markets. And that means colleges and universities. Right now, we have five colleges and universities worldwide that have terminated major contracts with Coca-Cola. The biggest university in Ireland, University College Dublin, 21,000 students, had a referendum and voted to ban all Coke products from all student-owned and operated facilities. We're talking about major bars and stores. About 5 or 6 weeks ago, the oldest college in Ireland, Trinity College, with about 14,000 students, voted the same ban, banned Coke products from the university. In the United States, Lake Forest College in Illinois, they switched to Pepsi. Bard College in New York banned Coke products and switched. And most recently, Carleton College in Minnesota. College of just 2,000. Coca-Cola sent five representatives, one from Atlanta, Georgia, the headquarters, one from Mexico City, and three from the Midwest. I was able to go head-to-head with them, and at the end of the night, the students who had control of the vending contract voted to terminate the contract, and they have removed 42 Coke machines from the campus. The last part that I would just want to add is that we also, part of our campaign, is going after some of the major financial players that are tied into Coke, namely SunTrust banks, when you find that they share the same people who run Coca-Cola and are the same people that helped to run Chevron Texaco, companies like Dow Chemical, companies, you know, that have terrible records on human rights as well as on environmental concerns. The last thing I'll sum up here, and look forward to the delegation, is perhaps the best way to tell you what the importance of winning this struggle against Coca-Cola is this. Juan Carlos Galvez, one of the union leaders that came to New York and came to this country to go out to speak to groups like this here, in August, he barely escaped assassination. Here he is, a man in his early 40s with a family, putting his life on the line every day, coming to students like yourself, asking for support. So he barely escaped assassination in August. In December, his brother-in-law was murdered in front of his pregnant wife. Juan Carlos Galvez told me this before he left. If we lose this battle against Coca-Cola, first we'll lose our union, next we'll lose our jobs, and then we'll all lose our lives. So that's why we're here tonight, is to ask for your support. to put a stop to these terrible conditions that Coke is involved in. And like I say, not just this, but you'll hear other concerns that Coke is involved in throughout the world. Now what I delight in is introducing Dan Kovalik, who's the Assistant General Counsel of the United Steelworkers Union, co-counsel with Terry Collinsworth, the head of the International Labor Rights Fund, of this major lawsuit under the Alien Tort Claims Act. And I want to just say this about Dan. Dan has a family. He's out of Pittsburgh. And let me tell you, this guy travels back and forth to Columbia, and he puts his risk at life, I believe, every time he gets down there. And with all due respect, he's one of the greatest people I have ever met, one of the hardest workers. Dan, come on up and...
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank everyone for coming here tonight. I understand that the students, you're getting close to the end of your semester and getting close to finals, so I really appreciate you coming here late in the evening to hear about human rights and workers' rights in far-flung countries. I want to just talk, first of all, a little bit about how the steel workers got involved in the case. Essentially, I'd been involved in Colombia for some time, and a priest in Colombia, who's also a human rights activist, came to me about what was happening at Coca-Cola and asked if we could, said that the union wanted people in the U.S. to organize an informal tribunal in Atlanta over these human rights issues at Coke. And I suggested as a lawyer, well, maybe we could do better. I mean, if it turns out that these allegations stand up, maybe we could have a formal tribunal. We'll go to court and sue them. So I went down to Colombia and went to Bucaramanga, to Barranca Bermeja, Bogota, Barranquilla to talk to workers and their families, and was really overwhelmed by their testimony and by what they had suffered. First, I want to back up just 1 second and indicate that, in general, Colombia is the most dangerous country in the world for trade unionists. Since 1986, over 4,500 trade unionists have been killed in Colombia. On a global scale, for every 5 trade unionists killed in the world, over 3 are Colombian. It's a pretty amazing figure for a country of 44 million people. Most of the assassinations are carried about these paramilitaries that you continue to hear about. According to our own U.S. State Department, and you should go to the State Department's website and download the country report on Colombia, for the last 2 years, the State Department has concluded a couple interesting things. One, that, again, that the murder of trade unionists is an incredible problem. Two, that it goes virtually unpunished in Colombia, that there's almost absolute impunity for these crimes. In fact, the State Department mentioned our case against Coke and another company as the result of this almost total impunity for these crimes. State Department also notes that the vast majority of these trade unionists are killed by paramilitaries, and that these paramilitaries are receiving assistance, ammunition, intelligence, troops, and even collaboration from the very military that the U.S. has been funding at the tune of $2.5 billion. Since the year 2000. So before I get right into the heart of Coke, I do want to urge people, because Congress is going to be debating this issue very soon, this military aid, to oppose continued military aid to Colombia. One way to do that is to go to this website, and you can, that's lawg.org, and sign a very simple petition. With that said, let me talk about Coca-Cola. Stephen Dudley, an NPR reporter, went to Colombia, met with paramilitary leaders who openly told him that they have bases around every Coke plant in Colombia to protect those plants. What are those paramilitaries protecting those plants from? Well, ostensibly, they would say from guerrillas, but they are also protecting them from trade unionists. In the case of Isidro Hill that Ray mentioned, the one fact he omitted was that prior to the murder of Isidro Hill, the manager of that plant had threatened to use the paramilitaries to wipe the union out. The union wrote to Coke to Panamco, the bottler there, to the U.S. Embassy before the murder and said, these threats are being made. We know what this means. We've seen this before. Someone is going to die. Nothing was done. Isidro Hill was killed within the walls of that plant. Ray mentioned this report by this councilman from New York who used to be a police officer. He just got back from a delegation there. His delegation found, quote, there have been a total of 179 major human rights violations of Coca-Cola workers, including 9 murders. Family members of union activists have been abducted and tortured. Most troubling to the delegation were the persistent allegations that paramilitary violence against workers was done with the knowledge of and likely under the direction of company managers, including, as you go on further in the report, actual payments made by managers to paramilitaries in Colombia. It's this type of collaboration between the company and the paramilitaries that we want to end. On the subject of investigations, this same councilman had asked Koch to do an independent investigation of these crimes in Colombia. Koch refused. We asked the same thing of Koch. Students and other activists asked the same thing to the general counsel of Coca-Cola, Deval Patrick, who publicly, because he felt some embarrassment when he was receiving a civil rights award, some embarrassment over this issue by people protesting there, said, Koch will organize an independent investigation of these allegations in Colombia. Deval Patrick got an independent group to agree to do the investigation. They recruited people to go down. They were ready to go down to Colombia, and Koch said, don't do that investigation. The Washington Post reported last week that Deval Patrick resigned on Easter Sunday because Koch refused to do this independent investigation. Javier Correa, who's the president of Sinatra now, and if you ever meet him, he's just, I don't know how to describe it except that he has this saintly quality about him. And he has said that to be a trade unionist in Colombia is to have one foot in this world and one foot in the next. And that for these Coca-Cola workers to stand up the way they are against these human rights violations is really taking their lives into their own hands. One of the worst things you can do in Colombia in terms of your own physical safety is to denounce human rights abuses like this. An interesting little anecdote, Javier, when you go to Colombia, you notice a lot of these unionists have like sidearms, little revolvers they keep in the square of their back. And Javier once told a story about this, about why he had them. He said, well, you know, what I tell people, they're not offensive weapons. They're not even purely defensive weapons in the way we think about it, that if we're caught by the paramilitaries, we'll be tortured before they kill us. So we'll just beat them to the punch and commit suicide. And that's what... why they carry these guns. Let me give you one more anecdote, which I think should be helpful to you in terms of what your power in changing this situation in Colombia. In the late 1970s, there was a Coke bottling plant in Guatemala where 8 trade unionists were killed in quick succession. The president of the union was killed. A new president took over. He was killed. 8 times this happened. At first, Coke, as in this case, said, it's not us, that's a franchise. We don't have control over that. But there was an international outcry, international activism of the type that we're asking you to engage in. Finally, Coke intervened, forced the owner of that plant to sell to someone else, and those murders stopped. And that's exactly what we're asking you to do today before there's another murder. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Dan was supposed to introduce me, but that's fine. My name is Amit Srivastava, and I am with a group called the India Resource Center, and also the director of a group called Global Resistance. We are a binational group. We are based in San Francisco, California, as well as in New Delhi, India. I'm very excited to be here today. Have been going to a lot of different campuses and different community groups in the U.S. And talk and engage with people such as yourselves on some very serious crimes of Coca-Cola in India. And we have also joined forces now with Ray and his organization and Dan in bringing the message to people around the world about Coca-Cola's crimes in Colombia, in India, and even the United States and other parts of the world, such as Ghana in Africa as well. And we are very interested in engaging with you and working with you to ensure that Coca-Cola does not renew its contract at the University of Massachusetts. And we hope to have a very good working relationship with the student body here and other organizations at the University of Massachusetts. Coca-Cola, a pattern has emerged as a result of Coca-Cola's operations in India. Coca-Cola, of course, makes its Coca-Cola drink, Diet Coke, Fanta. They have bought a lot of different drinks that were made by Indian companies. Coca-Cola alone controls about 40 to 45% of the soft drink market in India. So it's a very major player. Pepsi controls the other 40 or 45%. So a very significant player in India. They have something like 40, 45 different bottling plants all over India as well. So this is the place where they actually make their drinks. What we're seeing is that in at least four different communities in India, the communities who live around Coca-Cola's factories are experiencing the same things. What are these things? One is, suddenly, they have no more drinking water. A lot of these communities actually are dependent on the groundwater. Okay, so they actually drill or dig into the ground and use hand pumps to actually get the water, or they have wells to get the water. Since Coca-Cola started its bottling operations there, suddenly there is no more water left in those wells or in those hand pumps. So a lot of people have had to rely on buying bottled water or getting water for drinking, for bathing, what have you, from outside. And you have to understand that we're talking about India. We're talking about a country where there's a large-scale economic poverty in that country. A majority of the people who are affected by this water scarcity are indigenous peoples in India, farmers, a lot of women, and what we call Dalits. Dalits are what you'd call formerly untouchable people. Okay, these are people who do not have that much power and do not have that much economic security in that country. And so for many of them, it is rather hard to go and find alternative sources of water. It is not as simple as just going to a store and buying bottled water so that they can cook with it and what have you. So this is one pattern. This is one thing that's happening. We know of this in at least four different communities in India where suddenly the communities don't have any more drinking water. That's one. Now, second, what Coca-Cola has done, and in all these four communities, there is water but in the ground, but it has, you know, the water table has actually depleted. So you have to actually dig deeper to get access to that water, okay? Which people are doing, and when they're doing, they're finding water that is highly polluted. And even the state government and the public health agency has issued big notices, warnings, saying do not consume this water. Not even for drinking. Yes, do not drink this water, but don't even bathe with it because it is so toxic. Why is this water so polluted? Because Coca-Cola is dumping all the water that it uses in cleaning and stuff back into the ground. Okay, so this is what Coca-Cola is doing. First, it's extracting huge amounts of water. And then it uses, actually, Coca-Cola uses a lot of the water it uses is actually for cleaning the bottles and those kinds of things. It actually puts it back into the ground without treating it. And they use a lot of chemicals for the cleaning process, and so it's polluting the groundwater. Again, at least 4 different communities we know of have experienced and are experiencing this problem. Couple other things. Because Coca-Cola's record in India is scandalous, and it doesn't end with one of water deprivation or water pollution. It keeps on going. What we have found is that this outrageous, outrageous practice that is unheard of, at least in my life, I've never heard of this, that there is, as a result of Coca-Cola's bottling production of these drinks, there is, of course, wastewater that comes out that they're dumping into the ground, as I was talking about. But there's also some solid waste that comes out. There's this white, gooey stuff that comes out, okay? And this company, for the last 3 years, has been giving this white, solid waste to farmers in that area, saying, this is good for fertilizer. Go ahead and put it around your crops, and it'll help, you know, to your crops to grow better. We took some of that solid waste and took it to the UK. Actually, we're breaking international law, but doesn't matter. We didn't know at the time. Because when they tested it in a lab in the UK, they found lead and cadmium in that. That effectively makes this waste toxic waste. And you cannot just dispose of toxic waste by giving it to farmers for free. They would transport it to all these farmers around. And the farmers, you have to understand, these people are not, I mean, they're very rural people. They're not trained or educated in the sense that we are here, said University of Massachusetts. They do take a lot of things at face value. And, you know, this company, Coca-Cola, does put a lot of money into manufacturing this image of being the perfect citizen and all that stuff. So, you know, people don't usually question it. But here is this company that has been giving toxic waste to not one or two. And we're talking about hundreds of farmers who have actually used this. And it was only in September of 2003, after we brought attention to this, that the government of India actually had to order Coca-Cola to stop this practice, and they did. However, we are not sure what the long-term implications of the exposure of this toxic waste is going to be on children, on adults, on the farmers who have been using it. And then the last thing, the story keeps on growing. I mean, this is Coca-Cola. It's you'd think that one thing or, you know, so enough. But no, it keeps on growing. This is perhaps the next thing I'm going to tell you is the one that's got the most news internationally and in India as well. And it is quite outrageous. There is an environmental group in New Delhi decided that they were going to just randomly take Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola products from the Indian market, okay? Different products, including water, bottled water. And they were going to test it. At the same time, they got cans of Coca-Cola from the United States and also from Europe. And they tested these drinks in a lab in New Delhi, in a very good international standard lab. What they found in the drinks that were being sold in the Indian market were pesticides. Okay, they found DDT. They found another thing called malathion. And they found another pesticide called lindane that were at levels 30 times higher than those that are even allowed by the standards in the European Union or in the United States. And when they tested the bottles and the cans from the United States and the European Union market, they didn't contain those high levels of pesticides. Okay, and then our question to Coca-Cola was, so according to your science, are Indians able to absorb 30 times more poisons and pesticides than people in the European Union and United States? And obviously they have not answered that to this day. And this is a clear case of a double standard being employed by a large corporation such as Coca-Cola that chooses to have one kind of a standard in certain countries, in industrialized countries, and a very different standard where it thinks it can get away with these kinds of crimes, where lives to them are much more expendable, where they know that they can get away, as we see in Colombia, with murder, and in India, we would call attempted murder. And the good news around all this, there is a lot of good news, and the good news is that there are thousands of people in India who have actually taken to the streets and are organizing to hold Coca-Cola accountable for its toxic crimes, for its environmental crimes, and for its human rights crimes. Because a lot of people have, because of the water scarcity and the polluted water, a lot of people have actually lost their jobs, primarily farmers. I mean, they rely on a good water source and a clean water to grow crops. Suddenly they don't have that. And also, nobody wants to buy the crops that have been using these fertilizers, so-called fertilizer, once we broke the story that it's toxic waste, right? So now it's like, nobody wants to buy it. So if you are a farmer who used that, you can't find any buyers. And you have to understand, a lot of people here live on the brink they have a daily survival, okay? They're like day laborers, yeah? They make money today, they will eat. If they don't make money today, they're not gonna eat. It's that precarious. It's a very fine line between survival or for survival there, yeah? Now, so here's stuff I've told you. As I said, the good news is that these people have come out. We've had demonstrations, rallies against Coca-Cola. In one area, we had 8,000 people actually show up for a demonstration, mostly women, yeah? And as I said, it's very much national in scope, and we have now decided that we are going to bring the battle against Coca-Cola to its home turf, that is to say the United States. And this is the role that we as Global Resistance and India Resource Center are playing, that we work very closely with the various different local communities in India to actually challenge Coca-Cola in the United States and to ensure that it does the right thing. They have four demands, okay, and I actually passed out some brochures. If you didn't get them, you can get them up front here. One is to shut down two of the factories, all right? The second is to compensate the people who have been affected by the pollution and the deprivation of water. The third is to actually clean up and to recharge the groundwater and the land. And the fourth demand is to ensure that the workers who are laid off as a result of the shutdown are retrained and relocated by Coca-Cola. All right, so these are the four demands. Now, I'm gonna end here just with some final comments because, as I said, I mean, we have joined forces with the campaign to hold Coca-Cola accountable in Colombia, and we will be doing a lot of work, and I think a lot of work together, and I think we are both very interested, and we see the sort of importance of engaging with students in the United States, because a lot of changes internationally and even within the United States have actually come with student involvement, and South Africa and the end of apartheid actually is a very good example of the role and the power of youth and students in the United States and in the world. And so we look forward to working with you. And I have more to say, but we're not going to say it now. You know, we'll take it during the question and answer session. And if there's interest, we would like to have a strategy meeting here. Okay, and we'll talk about that. So thank you very much. And I have to introduce somebody. Very good to see a good old friend of mine. I was very surprised to see him here. His name is Ward Morehouse. He has been a long-time supporter of a lot of social movements in India and other parts of the world, but particularly in India. One of the few people from the United States who actually has followed and still follows and supports the campaign in support of survivors of the Bhopal disaster that people should remember. If you don't know it, you should go back and learn about it because it's a 1984 disaster where people are still dying as a result of crimes of Union Carbide, a U.S.-owned company, which is now owned by Dow Chemical. Ward Morehouse actually works with the Council on International and Public Affairs in New York. And he's also with a group called POCLAD, which is a very good engagement on, and it's called Program on Corporations, Law and Democracy. All right, here's Ward Morehouse.
Thank you, Amit, for those generous comments. I think it's only appropriate that I remind you that we are both doing God's work, you in your way, I in his. This is a pretty slow reaction of the audience, isn't it? Anyway, I've been told to be brief, and that's a good admonition, and I shall endeavor to do so. I want to touch on just three or four issues that have already been raised, some of them, others I think should be raised. First of all, the contract question. What would happen to life on this campus if there was no contract? The administration can't claim that it has to accept the lowest bidder if there's no contract at all. You know, something like this really happened in India in the mid-70s. When the Indian government kicked Coca-Cola out of the country altogether. And overnight, there was an incredible manifestation of indigenous equivalents of Coca-Cola. Indian entrepreneurs had no problem filling the gap. So let's have no contract at all for any kind of damn soft drink. We'll all be healthier for it. Secondly, as I think you all recognize, the big problem here is not that damned contract. The big problem is that corporations are trying to define our cultural values. And that's what we have to resist, and that's the struggle that lies ahead for all of us, and not just for students, because we're all affected by the way in which the corporations are increasingly dominating our society. Thirdly, I hope that out of the momentum that seems to be building, and I find that enormously exciting here, to get Coca-Cola off this campus, and I hope that's just the first stage in an exodus that's going to take in all the surrounding school districts, because they're bedeviled with the same damn problems that you are, and move on from there, and let's get Coca-Cola kicked out of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for openers, and go on from there. But let's also take all that energy and get a focus on the fundamental sources of corporate power, because until we tackle those, we're going to be forever, forever, forever fighting Coca-Cola or its equivalent over some lousy damn contract. Yeah, yeah. And this is embedded in our Constitution, 1st, 4th, 5th, 14th Amendments, in the Contracts Clause of the Constitution, in the Interstate Commerce Clause. Every single one of these have been instruments of corporate domination and rule in this society, and they need to be tossed out the damn window along with Coca-Cola vending machines. And finally, I want to remind you that the problems we're facing here are not new, and particularly the use of U.S. government power as an instrument for repression of indigenous movements in other parts of the world. Some of you, I'm sure, I hope, it'll be a measure of how effective you get an education you're getting here at the University of Massachusetts, will have heard of Smedley Butler. Smedley Butler was the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps in the early decades of the 20th century. He, when he retired, wrote a memoir. Fascinating book. It's been reprinted recently. It's worth all of us reading just to remind us that many of these problems and these struggles are not new. And he said this to say, sort of summing up his 33-year career in the U.S. military. He said, "I wouldn't go to war again as I have done to protect some lousy investment of the bankers. There are only two things we should fight for. One is our defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is simply a racket. Brother Bush, pay attention." I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. And then he had this to say to make his point even more vigorously. During these years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. Looking back on it, I feel that I could have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in 3 districts. I operated on 3 continents. And now, bring that back to the reality of today. And think of this odious New York Times foreign affairs columnist. If you ever want to get your adrenaline going in the morning, read one of Friedman's columns. They're really awful. But he's a realist in his own way. And it moves us to ponder how he sums up the relationship between corporations and U.S. government power in the 21st century world. He is, in fact, the architect of what I call the McDonald theory of world peace. He once wrote in a perfectly asinine column that no 2 countries, that had, each of which had McDonald's restaurants, had ever gone to war. Ponder that. The guy's crazy. Anyway, the hidden hand of the market, he says, and this is something we all need to ponder, will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, the builder of the F-15. And the hidden fist keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies. It's called the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. Keep up the good work. Thanks.